Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are John McCusker, author of Creole Trombone, Kid Ori, and the Early Years of Jazz, and award-winning science fiction writer Werner Vinge, who will be the author guest of honor at Contraflow 2 this weekend. John McCusker has spent nearly 30 years as a staff photographer for the Times-Picayune, sharing in the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism for the paper's coverage of Katrina and its aftermath. That knowledge of and passionate interest in our city is complemented by his love of early jazz. He began offering tours of jazz sites in the city in the 1990s, which led to his present New Orleans jazz history tours. Along the way, he became interested in one jazz musician in particular, Edward Kidd Ori. The subject of his fascinating new biography, Creole Trombone, Kid Ori and the Early Years of Jazz. Hi, John.
Hi, Susan.
It's great to have you on The Reading Life at last.
I'm so glad to be here at last.
I've been waiting for this book a while. So tell us, what are some of the sites in New Orleans that are associated with Kid Ori?
Well, certainly his home on Jackson Avenue, which is actually a success story in terms of jazz landmarks in New Orleans. The PRC found it. It was a crack house 15 years ago, and they rehabilitated it, and it's now an owner-occupied property.
Wow.
And in terms of the other side of the coin, you've got to look at the three buildings in the 400 block of South Rampart Street, the Eagle Saloon, the Iroquois Theater, and the Karnofsky Tailor Shop. Those are probably the three most important jazz landmarks on the planet, and they're all falling apart, demolition by neglect.
Ah, that's one of the tragedies of the story, isn't it?
Well, it is. But at the same time, you know, if you look at the later period where these musicians went to Chicago, that entire neighborhood has been obliterated, and there's really nothing left. So in that regard, at least we still have some things here that I can take people to and they can look at and imagine what it was like when Louis Armstrong and Kid Ori and King Oliver are all hanging out together.
Right. That tailor shop is legendary indeed.
It is.
So tell me, this book began when someone on your tour kind of challenged you about Kid Ori, right?
Right. Yeah. I was giving my jazz history tour, and a guy from California named Dave Ruffner was on the tour. And the representation I gave of Kid Ori was the one that I gotten from books, was that he was a sideman on the records of King Oliver, Jelly Roll Morton, and Louis Armstrong. And he was shaking his head, and he went, no. Kid Ori was so much more than that. Kid Ori represented the link between the earliest jazz pioneers like Buddy Bolden, whom Ori knew, and the ultimate jazz man, Louis Armstrong, who got his professional start in Ori's band. And I was peeved, and I went to my sensei in these matters, Dr. Bruce Boyd Rayburn at the Tulane Jazz Archive, and he took the other guy's side.
Oh, no.
And said, well, yeah, Kid Ori is an overlooked pioneer. He's intensely important. And, hey, there's no book on him. And there's a controversy about his birthday. This very esteemed educator had written an article where he challenged Ori's Christmas Day 1886 birthday. And I took that as a challenge. And my first assignment at the paper was staffing the River Parishes Bureau, which is in Laplace, which is Ori's hometown. So I knew what church he would have gone to. So I wrote away to the archdiocese and got his baptismal certificate written in French. And it confirmed that his birthday was indeed Christmas Day, 1886. And I got hooked. And Rayburn encouraged me over the years and said, look, you got to write a book. And I finally took the bait.
Well, we've got to give him some props. He's been the sensei for many a jazz scholar in this town. Now, another thing is that you dive right in to one of the oldest controversies in New Orleans writing, the whole notion of the word Creole.
Yeah, well, Creole is a word that gets applied to many different communities. And in terms of what that word means, particularly with terms of the Creole of color population, what makes and constitutes a Creole of color population in Cane River isn't necessarily what makes for a Creole population in St. John the Baptist Parish or in New Orleans' 7th Ward. And more importantly to Ori's legacy is there were Creole bands in New Orleans which were educated reading bands. Ori was not of that school of music. Ori came up in what was called the gut bucket style, which were guys that played by ear and played the blues in an improvisational way. So though he is Creole in terms of his heritage and background by any definition, Ori adhered to the uptown style, as it's sometimes called, of playing in an improvisational way as a non-reading musician.
And you also refer to it as the tailgating style.
Right, the tailgating style. Back in the day, if you wanted to advertise a dance or a political candidate, you would hire a band, you would put them on a wagon, and you'd send them around town, and they would ballyhoo whatever your cause was. And the slide trombonists would sit on the back of the wagon so they could work the slide of their trombone without bumping into the other musicians.
I know. I love that expression because you think, tailgating? No, we think of something else. Football season comes around. One of the really interesting things for me was how well you brought alive that culture of the way these musicians were also producers. They produced their own shows. They found the place. You know, worried about the tickets, worried about the food?
Well, particularly in Ori's case, you know, one day in his autobiography, which I was lucky enough to get a copy of and use in my book, he talks about playing a dance and watching the guys who had put on the dance count their money. And that was all Ori needed to see. And he realized that what he needed to be doing was not only performing, but also sponsoring the dances himself. And he did that even as a young man. In La Place, he started out holding fish fries as a way to attract a crowd, and then he would have his band perform for them. And when he got to New Orleans, he was so successful that he would rent out Economy Hall in the Treme, hold a dance there, and also rent out Cooperators Hall nearby and keep it dark to eliminate the competition.
Smart, smart.
Yeah, and I mean, this served Ori well through his whole life. You know, this isn't some musician that died in some flea bag hotel in the Delta, forgotten and unappreciated. When he retired to Diamond Head in Hawaii, and he was worth some coin.
I love that. I love that story. But tell me, you love early jazz. So what is it in particular about his music that gets to you?
Well, Ori was a stalwart of the New Orleans style, and he never departed from that. And what I love about New Orleans jazz is that it's so American. If you talk about E Pluribus Unum, the idea of out of many voices, one. Mm-hmm. When you listen to New Orleans jazz, you can listen to the trumpet and just listen to it playing the melody. Or you can just listen to the clarinet, which is playing variations on the melody, or you can just listen to the trombone, which will be playing bass figures or mirroring the melody and so forth. So you can actually listen to the same recording 100 times and hear it different ways every time.
Wow. So all that musical notation in the back of this book speaks to you.
Well, yeah, yeah. And, you know, that was one of the other fun things I was able to get. In addition to getting his unpublished autobiography and being able to put that material out there, in his papers I found reference to songs that he copywrote, but were never published, and he never performed them. So I was able, with help of my friend David Sager in Washington, D.C., to pull these from the Library of Congress and get them and publish them in the back of the book.
When any biographer undertakes this kind of prolonged relationship with a subject, there has to be something there, some spark, something that inspires you or draws you in. What is it about Kid Ori that kept you interested, kept you going? What did you learn about him or about yourself while you were writing this?
Well, you know, I never expected that I would spend 15 years of my life contemplating the life of another man. And it's very fascinating. On the day that I type the final period on the story, on the last chapter, and say that Ori was retiring from music and he was 47 years old, I was too.
Wow.
So, you know, it all kind of made sense in a way there. But the journey was as much about trying to become a writer as it was about contemplating the life of Kid Ori. Kid Ori was sort of the conduit for me to write about jazz. But it was really a process of wanting to become a writer, one that was inspired, in which I was inspired by my late wife, Johanna, and she supported me all the way. And really the final thing involved a woman too, the woman I was fortunate to meet and fall in love with after Johanna passed. And when I met her, and told her I was working on a book, she just out of curiosity asked, well, how long have you been working on it? And when I said 15 years, I realized how sad and lonely that sounded.
Oh,
and in part to impress her, I sat down the summer of 2011, and that's really when the book was written, and I just cranked it out.
Wow. Well, that's literary inspiration.
That's literary inspiration. So those were my muses.
Oh, well, what I love so much about it is the way you make the city come alive, the way you make him come alive. I mean, I felt like I was walking around in a different time period for a while.
I'm so glad that you say that, Susan, because, you know, when I walk around New Orleans today, I don't just see the New Orleans of today. Just like you can listen to jazz and hear the different layers of it. When I go through the city, I'm also seeing the city of 1912, and I remember what was there, and even though I wasn't there, since I had to go through and reconstruct that world, it exists on many different layers for me.
Doesn't it make you feel lucky to see that?
Absolutely. I love this city, and writing this book was a way of expressing that love.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with John McCusker, whose new book is Creole Trombone, Kid Ory, and the Early Years of Jazz. You can meet John McCusker when he signs that book Tuesday, October 9th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Werner Vinge will be the author guest of honor at the upcoming Contraflow Science Fiction Convention, October 5th through 7th. He's a retired San Diego State University professor of mathematical sciences, and you may know him, readers certainly know him, for his Hugo Award-winning novels. He's won that prestigious award 5 times for such works as A Fire Upon the Deep, A Deepness in the Sky, Rainbow's End, Fast Times at Fairmont High, and The Cookie Monster. He also wrote an amazing essay in 1993 called The Coming Technological Singularity. We're going to talk about some of those things today. Welcome to The Reading Life, Werner.
Oh, thank you, Susan.
Now, because this is The Reading Life, I want to go all the way back to your very first published short story, Bookworm Run. Tell us about the role of reading in that story. I love that idea of Norman Simmons, the reading chimp, hightailing it out of captivity with his books.
So the protagonist in the story was a chimpanzee that was raised to human levels of intelligence because he was connected wirelessly to a very powerful computer. And Norman's contact with reality, his understanding of reality, was rather strange, deep in some ways and shallow in other ways. Since he was raised in a lab environment and kept in a lab environment, his only way to learn about the outside world was about reading. And like a lot of children, including myself, his chief form of reading was very colorful, entertaining stories like science fiction and adventure stories. And so he regarded the whole world in this way. And when finally he became suspicious of the people doing the experiment, he managed to escape. And from there on, his dealings were with the real world, but now interpreted through his lens of fiction.
When I was reading your books, one of the things that I loved is that libraries and archives of information are so important, and so are archivists and people who've read a lot. And sometimes you poke gentle fun at people who say, well, I've read about that. But you seem to have such respect for that profession. I mean, and that seems to be an idea that intrigues you a bit.
Yes, I think an ideal description of the librarian profession is that they are the guardians of the past, and that's illustrated in many ways historically, but also the handmaidens of the future in the sense that the information that they are watching over and that they are making available to everybody is what it makes possible for us to go forward on top of all the rather remarkable advances that have already been made.
Now, how have your teaching and writing careers gone hand in hand? One of the things I love is that there are some wonderful teachers in your work, and teaching itself is a kind of subtext.
The way that the teaching and the writing of fiction worked out in my personal life has been that my specialty was mathematics and then computer science, and that I actually did not bring up science fiction or even science fictional type ideas in class. But I did use the radical situations that technology can cause. Those did come up in class, and I think it improved my teaching somewhat. And going in the other direction, of course, the being exposed to ideas about science and computers as I was in my teaching put me in a situation that I think suggested a lot of stories. And as you remarked, this sort of connection comes out in ways that it can occasionally involve teachers and librarians.
Now, one of the things you are best known for is articulating and describing and naming the technological singularity, which you think will take place sometime in this century. Give us the short definition of that, would you?
The technological singularity is the notion that the relatively near future, that using technology, that we humans will either create or perhaps become creatures that are superhumanly intelligent in every way that we now think of intelligence. And this, if it happens, is a different sort of technological progress than in the past. For instance, in the past, if someone invented the printing press or somebody invented the airplane, there were consequences that nobody could foresee. But on the other hand, you could describe the invention and you could describe the outcome in words that would be understood by the listener. So, for instance, if we had some magic way of talking to Mark Twain, we could explain the world of the year 2012 to him, and I think he would be enthralled by it since he was sort of a technophile. And in a matter of days, he would be up to speed about what's going on in our era. That's one type of technology, but if you tried to explain our world to a goldfish, the goldfish, in a very profound way, could not understand what you were talking about. And the difference between those two examples is Mark Twain and ourselves are roughly the same intelligence, although he's probably significantly smarter. We're roughly the same intelligence. But the difference between us and the goldfish is mainly that we are a lot more intelligent. And so the rise of superhuman intelligence, although caused by technology, is a different sort of technological progress than in the past. And so, in my view, it would be fundamentally impossible to predict what would be happening after that. And even more than that, it would be impossible to understand or explain it, even if you actually got to see it. And I think that's actually a good reason for calling the event the technological singularity, sort of by analogy with in physics, with a black hole. The idea of a black hole is there's very little information that you can get out of a black hole. Only a couple facts about what's going on inside a black hole that is available outside. And that, as a metaphor then for the era that I'm talking about, I think it's actually a metaphor that makes a good name.
Now, you've been wrestling with this idea and refining it and talking about it and thinking about it for almost 20 years now. How has this evolved? At the very beginning, you were even able to predict a time frame. And how have you gathered information to kind of confirm what you're thinking about this, that time frame, that evidence that it's coming toward us?
Well, one of my hobbies is that just sort of watch the passing technological scene. And it seemed to me, since the 93 essay was basically, I had my situation figured out at that point, since I had been thinking about it in explicit terms for 10 years or so and had a lot of chance to talk to people. And I came to the conclusion that it's actually a number of ways that technology can do this for us. These are very different ways. The internet, for instance, and the people that participate in the internet are one way that this could happen. Classical AI, artificial intelligence, is another way that it could happen. Increasing the intelligence of individual humans by their interaction with computers in the same way that happened with Norman Simmons in Bookworm Run, that's the third way. There's at least one or two other ways. And so I watch what's happening with technology. And most of the different technological approaches towards superhuman intelligence, they are going really quite well, I think, in the sense of making that sort of progress. The standard of progress that's often pointed to by people, which I think comes the closest to explicitly supporting, you know, numerical predictions, is just Moore's Law, the steady improvement of certain features of computation, or the number of transistors per square centimeter on a computer chip. That's been a very steady and exponential form of progress for a long time. There are various reasons why that is true, and there's no way of telling for sure that it's going to continue, although there are some good reasons to believe it is. And if you compare the computing power of the devices that are built on top of transistors with the estimated computing power of the human mind, that actually does give a person some numerical estimates of when, if we ever figure out the software, when we will have sufficient power to say that the machines are superhumanly intelligent.
Wow. So what do you think about the future of the book?
There's an example of where it's hard to keep my objectivity, since I am both, you know, technologically interested in very radical forms of change here, and also I have both a personal economic interest and a lifelong interest as a consumer of books. And I think that's what's going on with books is we can't really feel sorry for ourselves, because actually the whole world in every occupation is going through this, but it is a very stressful situation. I actually read almost all the books that I read now, certainly wherever I can manage to get them, read them on an electronic, you know, on a book reader machine.
Ah, you do?
Yes. And I have several reasons for that. The most personal and stressful reason is that I don't have the floor space for my book collection.
And that gets very stressful.
Yes. So I've given my book collection away to the University of California, and in return, they're going to do something for me that is very, very important. They're going to tell me the titles of all the books.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
Office, of course. I will end up with a card catalog, I mean, a file, but a file that corresponds to all the books and all the publishers and the year. And I'm very disappointed to have to give up my books, but I didn't have the floor space for it. However, having knowledge of exactly what I had is something that I can use. If there's any particular book or any particular passage in any book that I want to get to, even now, that's probably possible to acquire, if nowhere else on eBay. But it's, in the future, I think it's going to become more and more possible for me to get at these old books from my collection in a variety of legal ways. But that brings up the other, you know, the dark side of this, or the apparent dark side anyway, the economic pressure that this puts on authors when books can be pirated so easily. And this is a very large and a very complicated question, but I think there's also the very important fact that when books get old enough, it is important that that copyright not be forever, that really copyright is a gift that people in general have given to the writers, you know, to encourage them to write. But it is a gift that actually is very expensive for the people who made the gift. That is, you know, people in general will allow them, there to be these laws that about copyright. And so I think it's very important that copyright be something that eventually a book passes out of copyright and everybody can get it. And also I think anything that can be done to make it possible to get books legally with benefit to the writer before they go out of copyright is something that should be done. The work between Google and the Authors Guild, for instance, where they tried to reach some sort of agreement on how Google's massive digitization effort could be made available to people in general and do some good for the authors at the same time. I think that was a marvelously optimistic thing, and I'm very, very sad that, you know, it is currently hung up in all the ways I'm sure you're aware of.
Oh, yeah. Oh, but that's an amazing way to look at it. I have to say, I would love to have a list of all the books I'd ever owned. I can see why that is so thrilling for you.
Yes, I'm very, really looking forward. And every week, they have a person who's going through and doing it. And every week, I get a spreadsheet of the of the project as it currently exists.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I can't wait to hear more from you when you're here. You can meet Werner Vinge this weekend at ContraFlow 2, the second stage, which takes place October 5th through 7th at the Doubletree Hotel in Kenner. For more information, check out ContraFlowSciFi.org. Thank you so much, Werner.
Okay, thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Dan Baum discusses his book, Nine Lives, at the Waldenburg Art Center at Tulane University. Tulane professor Andy Stallings is October's featured reader in the 1718 reading series, Tuesday, October 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Collins Hotel. And this is Banned Books Week, the annual celebration of the freedom to read. Staff members at the East Bank Regional Library will read from banned books Tuesday, October 2nd at 7 p.m. Some of the books included are the works of Anne Rice, Madeline Lingle, Maya Angelou, and Alice Walker. In other observances, you can see Banned Books to Movies. The Kite Runner will be shown October 3rd at 5:30 at the Latter Branch Library, followed by To Kill a Mockingbird October 6th at 2 p.m., also at the Latter Branch. There will be a roundtable discussion about the freedom to read at the Keller Branch, Thursday, October 4th from 5 to 6, and Cornell Landry will read at the Algiers Regional Branch October 6th at 3 p.m. Cressley Cole signs Poison Princess Wednesday, October 3rd at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Tulane History Professor Christy Novella discusses two frequently banned books, James Joyce's Ulysses and Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses, Wednesday, October 3rd at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. William Cooper signs We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860 through April 1961, Thursday, October 4th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Peggy Sweeney McDonald and other contributors read from and sign Meanwhile, Back at the Café du Monde, Life Stories About Food, Thursday, October 4th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series presents poets Amanda Auchter, author of The Wishing Tomb, and Patrice Melnick, author of Po' Boy Contraband, reading and signing Thursday, October 4th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Contraflow is a conference for fans of science fiction, fantasy, and comics. It takes place October 5th through 7th at the DoubleTree New Orleans Airport. That's at 2150 Veterans Memorial Boulevard in Kenner. Special guests this year include today's guest, five-time Hugo Award-winning author Werner Vinge. Other special guests include North Shore novelist Diana Rowland and goth librarian Kimberly Richardson. There are writing workshops, panels, autographing sessions, and a 48-hour film festival. For info, check out contraflowscifi.org. Phil Sandusky signs New Orleans Impressionist Cityscapes, Saturday, October 6th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Crescent City Books celebrates its 20th birthday this October, with readings and receptions every Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. Kicking things off this Saturday is poet Carolyn Hembry, reading from her book Skinny. Poets H.R. Stony Stoneback, an English professor at the State University of New York, along with other New York poets Matt Nichol and Brad McDuffie, read their work Sunday, October 7th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. Andrew Carey discusses and signs The Land Was Ours, African American Beaches from Jim Crow to the Sun Belt South, Monday, October 8th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. John McCusker signs Creole Trombone, Kid Ory, and the Early Years of Jazz, Tuesday, October 9th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. And coming up, the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans sponsors an evening recognizing National Reading Group Month. Mystery novelist Attica Locke appears Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. at the Newcomb College Center for Research on Women. And Diane de las Casas signs Beware, Beware of the Big Bad Bear, Saturday, October 13th at 1:30 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.